cette pièce de piano peut vous sembler bien banale. À moins que l'on vous dise que c'est Jeanne, encore prof à 81 ans, qui l'a apprise à la petite Chloé lors de ses cours cette semaine. Le Québec est riche de ses aînés. Reconnaissons leur contribution. Un message du gouvernement du Québec.
From Turtle Island to Palestine, occupation is a crime. Free, free Palestine! You're listening to Radio Free Palestine.
Welcome everyone, you are listening to Under the Olive Tree, the Palestine Solidarity Radio Show on CQUT 90.3 FM in Montreal and on CFRC 101.9 FM in Kingston, Ontario. Stay tuned.
Thank you. شلحت بياضي لبست بياضي قلعت بياضي عريس راضي بنصيبه بهواها تنعنع لبست قميصة شلحت قميصة أخدت عريسة ماما بضمت نعنع وحرقت ضلوعي زودت ضلوعي وحرقت ضلوعي من كتر دموعي ماما عيوني ما بتشع
to the CJPME Debrief Podcast, a podcast of Canadians for Justice and Peace in the Middle East, and a proud member of the Harbinger Media Network. Together, we discuss developments and issues in Canada's relationship with Palestine and the broader Middle East. Through our conversations, we make sense of events in the region and how people in Canada can respond. Since its construction on a First Nations historical site, the Canadian Museum for Human Rights in Winnipeg has been mired in controversy. Throughout its brief history, interest groups have clamored for influence over the content of the museum's galleries, and the colonial dispossession of Palestinians from their land is just one of many human rights atrocities which has been ignored by the museum's content developers. Will a museum scandal in 2020 precipitate change, or will the museum continue to be dominated by perspective reflecting white privilege and special interests? My name is Tom Woodley. I'm the president of CJPME and the podcast host for today. With me is Michael B. Uchert, CJPME's VP, and our podcast co-host. Good afternoon, Michael.
Good afternoon, Tom.
Well, we have a very special guest with us today. We have our journalist, Candace Bodnaruk, joining us from Winnipeg. Candace has been active in Palestine solidarity for many years through her work with Peace Alliance Winnipeg. Among other things, she helped organize a vigil for Gaza in 2014 during the 51-day war. At the Folklorama Israel Pavilion in Winnipeg. She's also a freelance writer and a columnist for the Washington Report on Middle East Affairs. So welcome, Candace.
Thank you, Tom. Thank you, Michael.
Candace, it's really great that you have been following this story for, I guess, several years now. But I guess we should start by asking what actually got you interested initially in the whole issue of Palestinian human rights?
Well, I think it was in 2008 when a friend who was also very involved in Palestinian solidarity issues at the time invited me to go to a 60th anniversary Nakba event here in Winnipeg at Memorial Park. And I attended that, and you know, I was just so struck by everything that had happened, you know, during the Nakba, the dispossession of the Palestinian people, and how the Nakba continues today, of course. I just decided to become more involved and was more involved after that point, basically.
Well, so other than, of course, you live in Winnipeg, but what actually got you interested in the museum? I guess you've been following it for many years. What was it that originally sort of got you interested in the museum?
And we were actually there. I mean, the museum, as we pointed out, it did open in 2014. And in the summer there, or actually no, it was September, in September. And we were actually there in a protest at the opening with a number of other groups. So yes, Palestinians were key in those actions against the museum from the very early days. I mean, they were meeting with the museum staff, like you mentioned, Clint Curl. They were meeting with him back in 2012, 2011, 2010. About museum content, about the possibility of including Palestine in the museum. And of course, when the museum opened, there was no Palestine in the museum. So Palestinian community came out to protest, but also large numbers of indigenous people came out to protest. At that time, of course, as you mentioned a little bit in your introduction, the museum is built on a indigenous settlement that was partly excavated in couple of years previous, and the excavations were stopped so that the museum building could begin. Communities were quite upset about that. You know, there was a lot of artifacts there that were never retrieved. Those issues were not addressed. And at the time when the museum opened, a big issue was the water factor, the fact that the museum was using water from an indigenous community. Of course, Winnipeg gets water from Shoal Lake, which is a First Nation, and that was not being acknowledged. So the indigenous communities had teepees set up on the grounds of the museum as part of their protest. And people that were coming there, whether to visit the museum or to join in the protest, you know, that weekend the museum opened, they could visit those teepees, talk with the indigenous peoples and find out, okay, like, why are you here? Like, what's going on? And why are you protesting the museum? So it really was a show of community support against this institution, which really was not reflective of the community it was, you know, saying it represented.
Why don't we talk a little bit more about the museum and actually its sort of establishment? What was the tell our listeners, if you don't mind, what was sort of the original vision or the intent or the ownership there? I guess all these questions around the vision, the intent, the ownership, and the funding of the museum. So why don't you sort of try to describe that and take a few minutes and describe a little bit how this sort of came into being, if you don't mind.
Sure. Well, I mean, Israel Asper was, you know, a very, again, a wealthy businessman in Winnipeg. He owned Canwest Global, you know, television. And he was also he was a Zionist, already very much involved in funding projects in Israel, including school programs here in Manitoba for educating high school kids on the Holocaust. And he had a program where he sent them to the Holocaust Museum in Washington. So that was a program that went on here for many years. And the Asper family also funded these programs right across the country, from my understanding. So he wanted to model this museum, from what I've read, after the Holocaust Museum in Washington, but also the Museum of Tolerance in Los Angeles. It was intended to primarily be a Holocaust museum from the start. He went to Jean Chrétien actually in 2002 to sort of float the idea and see what Chrétien thought. And after some time passed, the Liberals did agree at that time, the Liberal government, to a $30 million down payment onto the museum. Okay. But I think at the time, Chrétien encouraged Asper to get private funding and support because he wasn't too sure how this kind of museum would fly, you know, in Canada, whatever, apparently at the time. And the Museums Act was actually changed because it was the first national museum built outside of Ottawa and the fifth national museum to be built in Canada, from what I understand. So it was Harper in 2007 who announced, Stephen Harper, who announced these agreements for the overall funding, which at the time I think had $100 million of federal funding and $2.17 million from both the province and the city of Winnipeg. And then there was also, I think, a large amount of obviously private funding in there as well. But the main funding did come from all three levels of government, which had chipped in at that point. And as time went on, the museum wasn't even built yet, and there were huge losses. Like in December 2011, they had capital losses of $350 million. And the governments, again, the three levels of governments decided to chip in again, and they made guarantees of the province and the federal government made up the cost, and they said, we'll give you $70 million in guaranteed loans, which it still goes on, I believe, to this day. And they opened in 2014, $90 million over budget.
Michael, I guess you looked up a little bit about the Asper Foundation. I guess you found a number of things. Anything you want to share with us, Michael?
Well, the Asper Foundation, I guess it's significant that they are a key founder of the museum because they've been involved for a long time in pushing initiatives in support of Israel. Israel Asper himself, when he was head of Canvas Global, had like really strict pro-Israel editorial policies and, you know, talked about the need to counter anti-Israel bias in the news and that kind of thing. And then the foundation is involved in a lot of different initiatives in Israel itself, including a number of different educational facilities, including one called a New Media Diplomacy Institute in Israel that is basically developing ways for Israel to tell its story to the world. So in other words, propaganda techniques. Then you have very recently, earlier this year, the Asper Center for Zionist Education established at Shalem College. And if you look at the map, it's actually located in an Israeli settlement in East Talpiot. If you compare its location on the map to settlement maps put out by B'Tselem or Peace Now, it's located right in a settlement that is legal under international law. And so this is, it is a foundation that is heavily involved in the colonization of Palestinian territory, as well as the fight for pro-Israel narratives. To have this organization so integral to the founding of this Museum for Human Rights and continues to be involved to the point where Gail Asper is still on the board of directors, it does, make you question whether some of the motivations for excluding Palestinians, whether that's deliberate or just a coincidence.
Yeah, it's sort of goes back to my point that to some degree, some of the leadership of this museum just really is not truly connected to the issues that the museum purports to represent and explore. Candace, I guess you visited the museum. You talked about the outside of the museum being a very beautiful museum. You visited it several times over the years. How would you describe it? Maybe give our listeners a sense of sort of what it's like inside and the types of things, though, the way it's laid out. Do you mind?
Sure. Well, what's going on right now? Like a lot of the museum, actually, from when I was just there the other day, it hasn't changed since last year. Like I know they were supposed to work. They said they were going to work on the content in terms of. One of the major things was the Black History Tour. And that was one of the things that they said they were going to have done by this year. So by phase one, because Laurel Harris, the person that wrote the report, rebuilding the foundation of the museum, that was one of the recommendations that, that came out of that report, is that they were supposed to establish a Black History Tour within, basically the first year of this report having come out. Well, phase two of the report is now out and they have not established that Black History Tour, which I don't know what that really says, but they say that they are working on it. They are doing a lot of consulting with the Black community. Now, in terms of the content that's there now, like I just went through there again with a fine-tooth comb and know the Nakba is not within the museum at all. They do have, they have their Breaking the Silence gallery, which has pretty much remained the same, which has what are considered, I guess, to be the main genocides recognized by the government of Canada, as well as the Holocaust, is in the same gallery, as a separate gallery on the same floor as this Breaking the Silence gallery. So they've got the Holodomor, Rwanda, the Armenian genocide, Srebrenica genocide, and then the Holocaust is also, it's part of that as well. They actually occur twice there, and then they have a huge gallery in there as well. Now, each of those genocides, though, they are just given one panel. So yes, they're included, but they do not have their own galleries. Like the Holodomor has one, basically a large panel with information. Armenian, the same. Rwanda, the same. And they are found in little bits and pieces, sure, throughout the museum in different spots. But that's basically all that's largely devoted to them. And then there were a lot of interactive boards and technology in the museum. And I went through and I looked at there's human rights through the ages, and you can find a year. And I did find 1948. And I clicked on that, 1948. And what came up was something about North Korea, but nothing came up about the Nakba. You know, this is not included in that museum. I mean, it's such a huge human rights story and has basically created the largest refugee population in the world. Like, the other thing is the Nakba is ongoing, right? The Nakba continues to this day. I mean, the Holocaust itself, it has ended. And for example, the Rwanda genocide has ended. You know, the Armenian genocide, these things that they happened, yes. And they were horrific, but they've ended. And I would argue Nakba continues today with what goes on in Palestine and Israel. And the treatment, ill treatment and genocide against indigenous people continues to this day, our indigenous people. So I would say those two things are living and growing and continuing today. And we need to be addressing them. And the museum does not address them at all. And they have that same world map up there where they have, says Israel, Arab-Israeli War, 1948. And that's how it's listed at the museum. Like, that's how it's designated. The word Nakba does not appear there at all. And I just think, you know, for the years that have gone by, that the Palestinian community has worked to get the Nakba included. And what they do say is, well, we like to tell these little human rights stories about people coming together and working together. So they still have a thing up there from this peace camp that happened in Ottawa a few years ago about Palestinians and Jewish people working together, and Christians. They have a little story about that. They have a story about the Gaza doctor, Dr. Ebelish. Yeah, the Gaza doctor, and his story, and I think that's great. His story should be in there, but that is not the story about what's happened to the Palestinians in full. Like, these pieces are also out of context, you know? Like, why does he have identity cards? They have them on display there. Like, what does that mean? Like, why does he need an identity card to go from Gaza, you know, to the West Bank? Like, you could tell that story there. Like, there's so many places in the museum where you could tell the story of the occupation and the Nakba, and they do have stories there of other refugee communities. And again, those are jumping off points where you could tell the story of the Nakba. They have spot the stories about children in war. You could tell the story of the state of Israel and how it regularly arrests Palestinian children and jails them, you know, in Israel in violation of international law. But those stories are not there. They're very careful not to include those stories.
Yeah. Yeah, you know, I one of the things that I was going to get to a little later in our conversation, but maybe I can jump to it right now. Like the new director of the CMHR, Aisha Khan, she actually said that she doesn't actually see the CMHR as being a place to sort of catalog all of the atrocities. Mm-hmm. I mean, how do you feel about that? I mean, to some degree, you've addressed that in what you just said, but maybe, you know, what do you think the role of the museum should be in terms of documenting atrocities?
Yeah, well, I think because they're trying to position themselves as being in an educational role, they need to provide some kind of information. And they were going for a while with this sort of model that they were basing it on the atrocities that the Canadian government recognizes or the genocides, and providing education on that. And because that's a way out for them, then they can say, well, because the government of Canada doesn't recognize Palestine, you know, we are not doing it.
Yeah.
But is it unbiased? I don't know. Like, I've got their mandate right here, which basically says that they are unbiased and that they are inclusive, and that they don't place their corporate mandate, that their balance of transparency and sound business practices, integrity and credibility of research and collective knowledge. Well, you know, yeah, I guess you could say that. There's just certain stories they've completely chosen to ignore.
Right, right. I think maybe if we gave Aisha Khan the benefit of the doubt and sort of said, well, there certainly have been a lot of atrocities throughout history. How do you sort of in some way record them all or document them all or present them all? So I think it's a fair sort of comment for her to make. What is the scope of the museum? On the other hand, I think earlier you made a very good point, is that there are certain atrocities are ongoing. Mm-hmm. You mentioned the Nakba, the Palestinian dispossession. You also mentioned the dispossession of indigenous people. You could also, I think, look at refugee situations. You know, one thing that I've often pointed out is there have been refugee crises throughout my life. You know, even the former Yugoslavia, there were refugee crises during that period. But those refugee crises have been resolved.
Exactly.
Whereas the Palestinian refugee crisis started in 1948, was exacerbated over the following 20 years, and is still unresolved.
Yes.
So, there are certain elements about the Nakba which would suggest that this is something that should be given some attention in the museum. Whereas, as I was saying, there have been other refugee crises in the 20th century, terrible refugee crises, which were resolved. From our perspective, there really is a place, there should be a place for the Nakba in the museum, especially given that is ongoing. I don't think any of us here in this conversation, I think the Holocaust, the Holodomor, the Rwandan genocide, the Armenian genocide, those are all terrible, terrible things that should be remembered, that should be documented. So I don't think anyone should take anything from this conversation to suggest that we don't think that those deserve a prominent place. The question is simply, shouldn't the Nakba likewise be featured prominently? And another thing, I guess, Aisha Khan has also said, and I just want to cover this point off. She has said that the Nakba that the CMHR actually does address the Nakba. And I guess our understanding when she says that, is that you've gone through these items, that there's a small exhibit about Palestinians and Jews and Christians working together at an event several years ago to talk about Dr. Abul Aish and his I Will Not Hate book and so on and campaign. But other than that, you haven't seen anything else that in any way relates to Palestinians in the museum. Is that right?
No. And if they're thinking about, as I mentioned, the small notation on that timeline, you know, the Arab-Israeli war, 1947 to whatever, to 1948, whatever they have there for time, that they are talking about the Nakba, but that's not what they say. And by saying Arab-Israeli war, right. Again, they make it seem like this is some kind of fairness, that the Palestinians had a military, had an army, and were fighting, you know, it was an equal fight. And that's not what it was. I mean, it was a complete expulsion, driving out of the indigenous Palestinians from their land, you know, and murder of women and children and the elderly and, yeah. And keep people fled. I mean, we know what happened in the Nakba, and we know what has happened now almost 75 years later, that, you know, that it continues. But to say that putting that on a timeline is the word Nakba. Well, no, the word Nakba is not found anywhere in the museum.
Yeah.
And the one thing I will add is what's interesting is the exhibit on the little thing about Dr. Abul Aish. is they do say that the daughters and the niece that died, that they were actually killed by an Israeli tank. And that is actually up there. And I'm surprised, because I would think that somebody would have, you know, taken that down at some point or gotten a complaint about it, because the fact that they mentioned it was an Israeli tank, I don't think would go over too well, you know, with the funders. But it's been left there. So that's interesting. But again, there's no context. What was going on there? Why was Israel attacking Palestinians? Why did they kill these children?
Why were civilians killed?
Right, exactly.
In, what was it, 2008? Was it? That was the 2000 Operation Gaslead, was it?
Yes, that's right. Yeah.
So in 2008, children, Palestinian civilians in Gaza are being killed by an Israeli tank. Right. Why would that be?
Right.
Exactly. Yeah. So that sort of confirms that sort of the museum, someone to some degree has been sort of gone through with a fine tooth comb just to make sure there's no mention of the Nakba and of the very legitimate grievances of the Palestinians. And I guess we might as well mention that you brought it up early, and we might as well cover that even before the museum was actually opened, that Palestinian Canadian activists were working with representatives of the museum and talking about having the Nakba in some way included. So this is not something that sort of Johnny be late, you know, someone came in, you know, just last year and said, oh, you know, you forgot the Nakba, even before the museum was opened. As I say, we'd like to do probably another podcast on sort of the whole, you know, the Palestinians involved with that and what they've tried to do over the years. But anything you'd like to say about those efforts or about the museum's response to those efforts?
Well, I think that at the time, I think the Palestinian community, you know, there were points where they were quite hopeful. They had good meetings with the different representatives of the museum. But I think that they kept hearing, one thing they kept hearing is that, well, Palestine can be represented, but it should be, as you mentioned earlier, something like a story about a cooperation between Palestinians and Jewish people and Christians, everybody getting along, or maybe highlighting, like, you know, one of these human rights defender stories, which I guess they consider Dr. Abolayesh to be. And you know what, that's fine. I mean, sure, he does have a place in the museum. I mean, I don't have a problem with that at all. But I think that that's not telling the story of the Nakba. Why do they need a human rights defender? You know, like what's going on there? Like, what's going on in Palestine? Yeah. And yeah, you just telling those stories in complete isolation, completely fragmented.
Right. It would sort of be like sort of trying to say, well, we had a story about Tutsi and Hutu that got together and sort of made up and created an organization. And that's, as a result, you know, we've addressed the Rwandan genocide. It's like, no, that doesn't do it, you know, or they got a Turk and an Armenian to talk together. And so that's all we need to say about the Armenian genocide. So let's talk now. I find it actually fascinating that the museum was mired in scandal. I guess it was in 20. I mean, we've already talked about some of the scandals. The fact that it was built on a First Nations historical site, and only 3% only 3% of the site was excavated before the construction of the museum had to proceed. But apart from that, and some of these other things, there was a huge scandal in 2020. Where the CMHR management was called out for a number of different forms of racism and discrimination and harassment. Indigenous staff reported instances of harassment and mistreatment by management. The reports of prevalent anti-Black racism, sexual harassment, and accusations that CMHR staff were asked to shield exhibits about the LGBTQ plus exhibits from school tour groups. You mentioned that briefly. And then an external review was commissioned, which actually published a scathing summary of the management of the museum in August 2020. A quote from the executive summary of the report reads: "So this is they had outside people go into the, you know, interview dozens of staff members at the museum, and in the executive summary it reads, racism within the Canadian Museum for Human Rights is pervasive and systemic. Employment practices, policies, and actions of employees within the institution have contributed to maintaining racism as a system of inequality. Black, Indigenous, and people of color have been adversely impacted physically, emotionally, and financially by their experiences within the institution. I mean, what was sort of the mood in Winnipeg when this came out? Like, what was the scuttlebutt, and how did people react to that locally there?
Well, yeah, from the people that I talked to, I mean, they obviously weren't very impressed, but I think for a lot of people, you know, they're involved in progressive politics on the left. A lot of people weren't surprised necessarily. Like the people that I work with in a lot of the activist work that we're involved with, you know, for Palestine and things like that. I mean, that they know already that the museum wasn't including Palestine, that they were very combative in terms of issues like that, and that they were kind of set in their ways and they weren't going to change, like in terms of the content at all. And so, yeah, from what I see with some of the recommendations, I mean, they have changed some things, but a lot, you know, hasn't changed, and the content definitely hasn't changed.
Mm-hmm.
Like they're doing this, you know, ongoing training regularly, which is good, on sexual harassment and racism, homophobia. Apparently they've already done 4,000 hours of training, and they're training not only their front-facing staff managers, but also the board of trustees is getting this training as well on implicit bias and things like that. And they've hired different people, like an equity officer, an anti-racism lead. They have put people like that in place. And Aisha Khan has met, you know, with stakeholder groups. Like one of the recommendations is that she become more involved and go out into the community and meet with groups that feel that they're not included in the museum. So she's gone out and she's met with gay and lesbian organizations, and I'm assuming Indigenous organizations, maybe some Muslim and Palestinian organizations. I mean, I don't know for sure on that, but I know that from what I've read, she has gone out and met with them. And they've also done 35 more interviews, this time with current staff that they've interviewed about what's going on in the museum. And there's a lot more in this report on the second part on sexual harassment training and how they're planning to deal with that. And they've already put, they put $250,000 towards education last year. And they're going to put more apparently this year for training on anti-racism, decolonization, homophobia, transphobia, things like that. And of course, when you're talking about colonization, you know, like what comes up? Israel, as well as Canada's treatment of its own Indigenous peoples, but as well as treatment of Indigenous peoples, you know, right around the world. But there, you know, those are colonialist stories that we will not tell, you know, fully in the museum and really address. But in terms of how they're dealing with the sexism and the racism, homophobia, things like that, well, I guess unless you actually go directly and talk to their staff, as the public, we're not really going to know. We're only going to say, okay, they've done this training, so that's good.
Yeah.
Okay, they've done the training. Are people still behaving like that? I don't know.
Well, I guess we should wrap up maybe with one final question. I mean, what do you think the future holds for the Canadian Museum for Human Rights, both on the sort of internal management side of things, and then in the sort of more visionary side of things, being more inclusive to situations like the Nakba and Indigenous rights? What do you think the future holds?
Well, I think that, I would like to be hopeful, because, you know, as a project from the beginning, I don't think that the museum had the right focus. I think it did need to be more inclusive. It was, you know, it was omitting so many stories that should have been pulled there. And then, of course, everything that came out about the harassment and the abuse, I mean, that is huge. And, you know, they went around the country, they interviewed Canadians way before they opened about what do you want to see in this museum. They had them tell their stories, including the Palestinian community. And then, you know, it came out, well, no, we're not going to include your stories at all. But I think that we have to be somewhat hopeful. People have to continue to write the letters, make the comments, you know, complain, write letters to the newspaper, write again to the Minister of Heritage, even though he says he's not responsible. Continue to knock on Aisha Khan's door and, you know, do the things like Rana has been doing and be hopeful because, you know, again, one day there'll be maybe another CEO, there'll be different management. All we can do, hopefully, is they will move forward and not move backwards again to the same place that they were before. Because, yeah, we have to hope that they've done little steps now for progress. We have to hope maybe one day it can be remade somehow. I'm not actually sure how that would be done, but I don't think we should necessarily throw the whole thing out. I think that there can be something else there. And I would hope that eventually one day there'll be someone who's, again, more progressive and they're willing to listen to include the Nakba. But at this point, you know, because of the museum structure, like you've got Miguel Asper as part of the board of trustees. And I don't believe that she has an intention of allowing, you know, those stories right now to be told in the museum.
Yeah. Well, she's not just a member, at least the last I looked, she was chair of the board. Is she still the chair?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, yeah. So it's even more important than just being a member of the board. She's chair of the board. Right.
So people can make those proposals and, you know, they can say, yes, we're listening. We want ideas about how we can make this a better museum, what we can do to tell these stories. And that's what they'll say. But that doesn't mean that, of course, it's going to be done because of who's heading it up. This point, you know, if you tell the story of Palestine, well, then, you know, you also have to tell you're going to be telling the story of Israel. Mm. And they don't want that story of Israel being told because Israel is this human rights beacon in the world, right? Or that's the story that they tell, you know, that's told to the world.
Or the pro-Israel group sort of put forward is that, you know, yeah, absolutely. So I think you make a good point, Candace, in terms of we need to be hopeful. Mm-hmm. But it sounds, I agree with you. Basically, what I understand you saying is change isn't going to come from within. It's got to come from without. And you want to say something, I guess, Michael?
Well, I think it might be worth pointing out that last year we did start a campaign to put some outside pressure on the board to acknowledge Palestinians and to include the Nakba in the museum. And that's still an active campaign. I got the sense that it did attract some attention. Like it did make a bit of a difference. And people were paying attention. It's one of the campaigns that I've seen the most backlash to, in the sense that once we had a webinar, we had this campaign, and a lot of the pro-Israel groups were very vocal in against this campaign. And there were a lot of articles about it in pro-Israel media about how, you know, the museum should never acknowledge the Nakba and that kind of thing. And it struck me as such an interesting phenomenon because what are people so afraid of just to have something so basic as a people's history and the story of the human rights violations against them? What's so threatening about including that in a museum about human rights? But there seemed to be a lot of opposition to that. So I don't know what that means, but I do think that there is a lot of, interest, positive and negative. And I think with more pushing, I do think that there is some progress that can be made.
Yeah. But again, progress is going to come from the outside, not...
Exactly.
Clearly, from the track record so far, it's not going to come from the inside. Well, Candace, this has really been a really interesting conversation, and I really appreciate your taking the time to walk us through this again. I think it's important for Canadians to have sort of a broader sense of where this museum came from, why it is the way it is, or why potentially it is the way it is, and what can be done to shape it sort of moving forward. Is there anything you'd like to say in closing, Candace?
Oh, I just wanted to add as well, sort of on some of Michael's points there too, that what's really important to remember is all the government funding that this museum receives from the Manitoba still, of course, from the federal government, basically these loans, these permanent loans going into the future, to keep it operating and pay the salaries, as well as the, you know, the loans, the money that they got from the city of Winnipeg, just that government money alone, this entity is not run by private donations. It is a government museum. I mean, the Minister of Heritage oversees it. It is a national museum. And therefore, it is accountable to Canadians, you know, to reflect all Canadians. I mean, we need to, that content needs to be representative. And it should not be based on people's whims and biases in terms of what they think shouldn't be included. And it should not be censored. And Canadians need to demand that these stories are told in the museum. And we know, as you said, there were Palestinian groups right across the country from the beginning that demanded that these stories be in the Canadian Museum for Human Rights. And they should be there. And so, as Michael said, we need to keep moving forward and pressuring the museum, because I think it can be an inclusive place if we push for that hard enough. I mean, so many institutions have had to change in this country because they're not representative. And I mean, that this museum should not be able to hide from that. I mean, they should reflect, you know, the Canadian population, and they should reflect the, you know, the human rights issues that we want in there.
Absolutely. Those are great points to close with. Great comments to close with. Indeed, it is a Canadian museum, and we're paying for it.
That's right. I think people forget that. And, you know, it's not it started out as really a vanity project. I should maybe say that, but a vanity project of the Asper family. But now, no, I mean, we are stuck. I don't use this term very often, but we are stuck with this bill, you know, for this museum. So yeah, it should be reflective of Canadians and of the human rights issues that are out there. And yes, for education, because people are learning about the human rights issues that they want us to learn about, but we're not hearing about all of them. So we're not hearing about the Nakba. So if you didn't know anything about the Nakba, you wouldn't know it was missing from the museum, right? Because they've just decided not to include it. It's not even the coverage of the Nakba or the depiction of it. It's the fact that it's not depicted at all. It's completely absent, and that is wrong, and it's very disappointing, and that needs to change.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, thanks again, Candace. Just a fantastic overview of the history, the context, and the issues that the museum is mired in. And I look forward to revisiting this conversation in the future. And if you're a listener with us today and you've enjoyed our podcast, please subscribe to our channel. We're on all the major audio podcast platforms. If you can, please leave a positive review wherever you get your podcast. It helps other people to find our program and to learn about the issues. This podcast is a project of Canadians for Justice and Peace in the Middle East, CJPME, and seeks to advance its mission to empower Canadians of all backgrounds to promote justice, development, and peace in the Middle East. If you have any comments, questions, or suggestions about our podcast or our topics, please feel free to email us at info@cjpme.org. Thanks to all of our supporters who make this podcast, as well as all of CJPME's other activities possible. And thanks also to Madeline Moffat, our podcast engineer and consultant. So that's it for now. We look forward to having everyone with us again at our next podcast. Take care. See you all again soon.
A place where we can be more than thunderclaps and hashtags. A place where we are human and our fears not Twitter storms, our flesh not dissected in comment sections. Is there a place? Is there a place where we can be more? More than thunderclaps and hashtags. A place where we are human and our fears not Twitter storms, our flesh not dissected in comment sections. Is there a place? Is there a place where we can hold each other in sorrow and silence in defiance, in sorrow and silence in defiance, before you make a picture funeral to share widely, another name fallen? Is there a place? Is there a place? Is there a place where the headlines don't hate us or assume that we mysteriously die? just fall and are never killed intentionally by soldiers taking orders intentionally, by snipers taking aim intentionally, by companies making war intentional. Is there a place where the headlines don't hate us? Is there a place where the headlines don't hate us? And our life, like our laughter, is intentional. Is there a place? Is there a place I don't have to justify how our lives are also sacred? Our lives also matter, and we also love our children. Is there a place where the breaking news, like breaking waves, doesn't just bring more bodies from the Mediterranean? Is there a place? Is there a place? Is there a place where we are more than horror stories and numbers etched on helmets? Stars for generals who calculate the calories to the brink of life. Is there a place? Is there a place? Is there a place? Is there a place? Nothing extraordinary, nothing magical about its oranges, nothing too blue about its skies, just a place where we can be, just a place where we can sit under a tree, just a place where we can be, where we can be, where we can be.
أيها الساقي إليك المشتكى قد دعوناك وإن لم تسمعي ونادي من همت في غرته وشربت الراحة من راحته كلما استيقظ من سكرته جذب الزق إليه واتكى وسقاني أربعا في أربعي أيها الساقي إليك المشتكى قد دعوناك وإن لم تسمعي غصن بان بل من حيث استوى مات من يحياه من فرط الجوى خفق الأحشاء موهون القوى كلما فكر في البين بكى ويحه يبكي لمن لم يقعي أيها الساقي إليك المشتكى قد دعوناك وإن لم تسمعي ما لعيني عشيت بالنظر
أنكرت بعدك ضوء القمر وإذا ما شئت فاسمع خبري عشيت عيني من طول البكاء وبكى بعضي على بعض معي أيها الساقي إليك المشتكى قد عوناك وإن لم تسمعي ليس لي صبر ولا لي جلد ما لقومي عذلوا واجتهدوا أنكروا شكوي مما أجدوا مثل حالي حقه أن تشتكى كمد اليأس وظل الطمع أيها الساقي إليك المشتكى قد عوناك وإن لم تسمعي كبد حر ودمع يكف يعرف الذنب ولا يعترف أيها المعرض عما أصف قدما حبك عندي وزكى لا تقل إني في حبك مدعي أيها الساقي إليك المشتكى قد عوناك وإن لم تسمعي وندي من همت في غرته وشربت الراحة من راحته كلما استيقظ من سكرته جذب الصدق إليه واتكى وسقاني أربعا في أربعي أيها الساقي إليك المشتكى قد عوناك وإن لم تسمعي غصن بال مل من حيث استوى متى من يحياه من فرط الجوى خفق الأحشاء موهون القوى كلما فكر في البين بكى ويحه يبكي لمن لم يقعي أيها الساقي إليك المشتكى قد عوناك وإن لم تسمعي ما لعيني عشيت بالنظر أنكرت بعدك ضوء القمر وإذا ما شئت فاسمع خبري عشيت عيني من طول البكاء وبكى بعضي على بعض معي أيها الساقي إليك المشتكى قد عوناك وإن لم تسمعي ليس لي صبر ولا لي جلد ما لقومي عذلوا واجتهدوا أنكروا شكوي مما أجد مثل حالي حقه أن تشتكى كمد اليأس وظل الطمع أيها الساقي إليك المشتكى قد عوناك وإن لم تسمعي كبد حر ودمع يكف يعرف الذنب ولا يعترف أيها المعرض عما أصف قد نما حبك عندي وزكى أيها الساقي إليك المشتكى قد عوناك وإن لم تسمعي أيها الساقي إليك المشتكى قد عوناك وإن لم تسمعي أيها الساقي إليك المشتكى قد عوناك وإن لم تسمعي
So that's it for us for today. You're listening to Under the Olive Tree, the Palestine Solidarity Radio Show on CQUT 90.3 FM in Montreal and on CFRC 101.9 FM in Kingston, Ontario. Until next time, I wish you a free, free Palestine.
This piano piece may well sound ordinary to you, until you realize that it was taught to young Chloe just last week by Janet, who's still teaching at 81. Seniors bring so much to Quebec. Let's recognize their contribution. A message from the Gouvernement du Québec.
Business. So I know that the streaming business as much as the next guy in the industry, but I can't say like every nitty-gritty detail of every agreement they have with all the societies and all that. So I guess I'm a good observer, but like for very, very pointy questions, maybe other guys or girls in the panels are better suited to answer very pointy stuff.
We're all here to learn, so
yeah, we're all here to have an open discussion and to share our feelings and thoughts.
Yeah, also you have like so much experience with the sync side.
Yeah, I do.
Things also, so like other revenue streams that can help us to
Because syncing is another great revenue for artists right now.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so it's 12:01. We're gonna start letting people in. Let's get underway. And have a good time.
Thank you. Thanks.
Okay.
All right. I think we're ready to start.
Hello, everybody.
Hello.
I'm just going to ask for a standard Zoom housekeeping thing to make sure you're on mute. That the majority of the roundtable discussion, there will be a chance at the end to ask questions.